Welcome back to The Peaks, everyone. I'm so excited to have you with us on the show today because I'm here with my good friend, Jenny Lefkor, a partner at Freestyle Capital. Jenny, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Before we dive in, can you give everyone a brief intro into your work at Freestyle?
Yeah, so I am a partner at Freestyle, and we are a $60 million seed stage fund. Me and my two partners are serial entrepreneurs, or we're serial entrepreneurs. So we approach our investments very differently in that we work with our portfolio companies and as sort of an extension of the team and get in there and kind of do everything that needs to be done to get our portfolio companies to that next milestone, which is usually a very successful Series A. And so at this stage, we see ourselves very differently than your typical VC in that we roll up our sleeves and, you know, we've walked a million miles in our entrepreneur's shoes.
That's a really perfect transition to the first lesson that we're going to talk about today for the Learn theme with We Festival. And that's deciding what's on the critical path and what you don't need to focus on. Can you tell us about how you learned that personally?
I love telling the story about how I learned it because I was very fortunate to work with a man by the name of Doug McKenzie. He was a partner at Kleiner Perkins, and Kleiner Perkins had led our company's, what would now be called seed, was then called Series A round, our first round, back in the late 90s. And we were an aggregated gift registry. And what was critical to our success was signing up the major retailers, the Macy's, Williams-Sonoma, Crate and Barrels of the world. And when we would give Doug updates, we would tell him about our new logo or we had picked an advertising agency. And we would give him these updates and he would say, "You realize that none of that matters, right?" What do you mean? What? He's like, "Everything you just told me does not matter. That's just stuff you get done and you don't even need to talk about. The only thing that matters are those are the retail relationships. Where are those agreements? And when I need an update, I just want to understand the things that are on the critical path because none of the other stuff matters." And it was one of those moments where the lights went on for me. There are things that will make or break your business. And then there's all the other stuff that you can get done or not get done. And it doesn't really matter. It's not going to ultimately impact your business. And so after that, we never got confused again. Or if we did, that man set us straight. And so now it's been really nice. I was so appreciative as an entrepreneur for him turning the lights on so brightly as we walked down that path of what was really important and what was not, and never confusing those two. So as an investor now, I try to provide that same light to my entrepreneurs. Some of them just don't need it. They're crystal clear. But a lot of entrepreneurs do need it. And you get so caught up in being busy, and sometimes you can confuse yourself about what matters and what doesn't. And so making sure that we're all really clear and aligned on what is on the critical path, what absolutely make or break has to happen to make your business get to that next milestone, and what's sort of the nice to haves. And they're interesting, but let us not fool ourselves into thinking they actually matter.
Whether it's one of your portfolio companies that you've helped with this or in your direct experience, can you give us an example of deciding between what was critical and what wasn't, even if it was a really hard decision of something you wanted to do, but it just wasn't vital?
I mean, there have been so many. There's really what you need to do is think about, how am I de-risking this business between here and my next milestone? What am I going to do so that I, what story am I telling to that next investor, right? And when you know what you need to be in that next period of time, you work backwards, it's really clear what has to be done and what doesn't have to be done. So I did this this exercise with one of my portfolio companies. And once we did it, they realized that mobile was nice, but not critical. And they removed it from the product roadmap and they actually had to lay off their mobile engineer because it was nice to have. It definitely will be a part of their company's future, but it didn't have to happen between here and their next milestone to prove the value of the company. It would not add value, so therefore, better to not do it. So, one of my favorite terms is telling people to work backwards. Where do you want to be in a year from now? And then what has to be done to be there, right? What key metrics and where do they have to be for you to be at that place?
I love that. And the biggest question that stands out for me, it's something that I struggle with, is how often am I supposed to be asking myself what's on the critical path and is this a nice to have?
I mean, I ask myself hourly.
I'm not
exaggerating. Oh, absolutely. I look at my calendar. Now, it's harder as a VC. I must tell you that sometimes I envy. I'm a focused individual by nature. And so it's really clear when I'm an entrepreneur what is very important and what's not. But as a VC, there's a lot of serendipity. There's a lot of networking. So it's a little bit harder to make that call. But I am constantly, as a VC, I'm constantly looking at my schedule and wondering if I'm optimizing it. Where am I putting my time? What do I need to do that actually matters and has to be done versus nice to have? But it's even more clear as an entrepreneur. And I have told people in the past, like, of course, networking is important to your business and you can meet incredible people that do incredible things. But at the end of the day, I think that you're going to be much better off if you know exactly what you need to do, your head's down on doing it. And then if you attend an event, you're sort of surgical about your networking. You know who you want to meet, you know why you want to meet them. Because networking or just kind of doing stuff because it's just stuff that you hear is good to do, that doesn't get you where you need to get to as fast and as clearly as really being conscious of how you spend your time and make sure that you're brutally honest about everything that you're doing is working on moving and pulling on those main levers that drive your business.
I love that you said that because there's so many things that everyone is always saying to do. So like social media is an example. It's really important, but it can suck away half of your day. What are some things that, you know, are commonly said entrepreneurs and VCs should be doing, but aren't 100% necessary?
Well, I'm going to keep that one focused on entrepreneurs. But on entrepreneurs, I think that a lot of people tell entrepreneurs that they should always be meeting with VCs and building relationships with VCs because then one day when they're ready to raise their next round, they have a relationship and that will be easier. I actually believe that you should just keep your head down, focus on building an incredible company and pulling on those key levers that are going to drive your business and make your business very attractive. Because if you meet a VC and you have an incredibly tight, attractive story to tell, VCs will be very interested, even if they recently met you. And if you spend a ton of time constantly speaking with VCs and networking with VCs and building all these relationships with the VCs, but that takes away from you actually making your metrics be where you need them to be, then no matter how much they like you, they're not going to want to invest in you.
That makes so much sense when I hear you say it, and it goes really well to the second lesson we're going to chat about today, which is that practice makes perfect when you're pitching to VCs. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's one of those things that I think is counterintuitive to a lot of people because a really good meeting with a VC feels like a conversation. You sit down, half the time you don't even take out a pitch deck. You chat about your business. And when you do a really good job chatting about your business, you're very tight about how big your market is, the problem that you're solving, the solution you're building, the traction you've had, what your next steps are. And you can make it conversational and it flows so well. The ones who are masters at that, believe it or not, are the ones who have agonized over their pitch and their deck for a while before they had those quote unquote natural conversations. So practice makes perfect. When you have to put pen to paper and be really disciplined on, okay, I want to convince the VC that this is the problem in the market. Okay, what's the best way for me to tell them that? Is it to give an example? Is it to do it this way, to do it that way? And you play around, then you find the way that it works. And you do that for every kind of key element of your story. And then you practice it and you practice it and you practice it. And then when you get to the other side, what comes out is a very natural, tight way of speaking about your business. And no one knows or feels the fact that you've practiced it. So a lot of entrepreneurs have pushed back on me and said, oh my God, I so don't want to practice my pitch. I don't want to be robotic about it. It's like, no, robotic is how you are after you practice it once or twice. When you practice it 15 times, you're no longer robotic is coming out of you, you know, just period, like without even trying. And that way, when the VC asks you a question, you can answer it, then you can bounce right back to your story and take them back to where you wanted them. Versus if you haven't, you can kind of get lost.
What were your experiences like when you were an entrepreneur fundraising?
Yeah, so when I was an entrepreneur fundraising, I was just a big believer in, I will never regret being overprepared, but I will definitely regret being underprepared. And so being able to really practice telling that tight story, you know, I love the Mark Twain quote, if, you know, I would have written a shorter letter, but I didn't have the time. So taking the time to really tighten your story to the key elements so that the VC can have the aha moment and then be ready to go deep into any question they have to have that answer. So, you know, a lot of people call it altitude switching. So, you know, you can tell the story at the 30,000 foot view and keep all parties interested. And then the moment someone really wants to understand no more, you can go down into the weeds with them or go down to a lower altitude, answer their questions, and then bring it up to a higher strategic level.
What was the best lesson you learned raising your first round of funding?
You can't underestimate sometimes the insights you have into a market that may seem obvious to you, but are not obvious to everybody else. So when we were first raising money for WeddingChannel.com, it was the time when Amazon.com was basically, you know, killing Barnes & Noble, and our investors, you know, Kleiner was in Amazon.com, and you had a group of men sitting around the room, you know, at the partner meeting, really grilling us and questioning us on why the hell are you going to work with retailers in this day and age? Go sell Wedgwood China from your warehouse, have brides register with you, own that full stack experience. Like, this is, you're swimming upstream, ladies. Like, this is the time to go against the retailers and put them out, not work with them. And we had to explain to this group of men that that is not the way the world is going to work for a while, that people were attached to their brands. This was the biggest day in their lives, and they were going to continue to register with the brands that they know and love, that their guests will feel comfortable buying from. And maybe in a decade or two, that will change. But right here, right now, that will be very, the margins may be better, but that will be a business that won't last more than a year. And we were right. There were some doing that and they went under. And our sort of knowledge of the market and knowledge of consumer behavior proved to be true, where our company still exists today. Now, today, I think that there could be a company that could maybe be successful in that. So I don't mean to say that's the successful model forever, but you can't underestimate understanding your market and understanding what their appetite is, even if some other models seem more appealing.
Whether it was on your business model, your pitching style, or just the early days of being an entrepreneur, what was the best feedback you received during your time fundraising?
I don't remember, to be honest, I don't remember the feedback we received as much as the fact that we got funding. And that's what that's the best feedback that there is. And when I'm talking with entrepreneurs about VCs, I always tell them not to pay attention to the words that the VCs give you. Because the, you know, talk is cheap and action and you know, the time that they spend with you is everything. So when a VC is smiling at you and telling you it sounds so great, they nod their head, you leave the room, you never hear back from them. Not uncommon at all. When people are digging in saying, I really want to understand this or that about your business. Can you send me this? Can we meet again? That's someone who's really interested. So I would just say, you know, what feedback I heard, I don't even remember. But I do know that we were able to get top tier VCs very interested in our business, which was the greatest feedback of them all.
Knowing what you know now, do you think you would have done anything differently?
I mean, that seems like a loaded question across my whole life.
Oh, no, just fundraising, not your whole life.
Fundraising, yes. I would say that I overcapitalized my businesses. There was a time when we could. And it was, we were trying to get bigger, go home. And I think that sometimes too much capital doesn't create the discipline that startups need. So in general, I think that you really want to make sure that you have the traction and the metrics that sort of are worthy of the capital coming in so that no matter what, you just, you know, you are never sloppy with a dollar. And we didn't misspend, we didn't throw parties or anything, but we probably could have gotten better and tighter faster if we had to.
I'm so happy that you mentioned that, because I feel like lately I've been seeing a lot of insights that you should raise as much money as you can while you can. Do you agree with that, or do you think that mentality is better?
It's really hard to just kind of give a point of view on that overall. I do believe that you never know when capital will be available or not. And so Kleiner used to have a term, you know, make sure to grab an hors d'oeuvre when the tray is passing you by. And I do believe in that, because you just don't know in these capital markets when people are going to get really spooked and stop writing checks. On the other hand, if you raise too much capital for the time that you're in, that sometimes causes sort of the opposite effect. And just, you're not as disciplined. You don't figure out what you need to figure out as soon as you should be figuring it out. And so you just, you know, any resource you're sort of rich in, you don't usually value as much. So I think that there is a point where it's too much capital. So finding that line is important, and that's going to be different for every business, and that's going to be different for sort of every point that a business is at.
And now that you're an investor and you're on the other side of the table, what insights do you have for the companies you're working with, or just entrepreneurs you meet? I know you meet with so many, on how to run the financial side of their business tight and smart.
Once again, it goes back to what's your next milestone, right? What are you trying to hit? And what do you need to do to hit it? What really, really matters? I recently met with an entrepreneur, I'm not an investor, and he had been so tight with his capital that his product wasn't impressive. And I actually told him, like, you have to use your capital as ammunition, not as oxygen. So it's keeping you alive. But you need to be better than alive. You need to make it so that it makes you great. And so sometimes you can sort of underspend, and you forget that you're going to be judged on that product experience. And without that product experience being a wow, you're not going to make it to the other side. And other times you can start saying, I'm going to, you know, we need to develop the mobile app, or we need business development, or we need, it's like, you're going to need those things, but you actually don't need them yet. And fewer initiatives done really, really well to get you to that next set of milestones is what you want to focus on, and only focus on those things. And there is nothing on your to-do list that does not take away from the other things. So anytime anyone tells you, I'm going to do those key things that matter, but I'm also doing these other things, it doesn't work like that. So anything else that you add takes away from that key, that sort of maniacal focus you could have on the things that really matter.
That is so well said. That was such a quotable. I can't wait to write that down in my notebook. You're going in my
notebook. I said, I may have stolen that from someone, just so you know.
I can write Jenny and Friends.
It's possible. It's okay. It's possible.
Before we go, I'm really excited to dive into the third lesson we're going to chat about today, which is that when it comes to hiring and building your startup team, missionaries outperform mercenaries. Can you dive into that and share your experience as well as what you've seen?
Absolutely. So I did steal that missionaries outperform mercenaries from my old business partner, Jessica Herron, who is the CEO and founder of Stella & Dot. But it's really about having a culture where everyone sees the vision and wants it, and can really understand what they're trying to create. And if people are ready for that journey, and you have a really strong culture fit, you and they're bright enough and hardworking enough, people can figure things out. And so I made mistakes in my past where I had my companies being further along, and I said, okay, well, now I'm going to hire someone with a resume, right? Now I'm going to hire someone who's done this before at these big companies. And it's a very different kind of person. And I don't mean to knock all people who work at these really big companies, but sometimes big companies, you're a little bit more political. You're a little bit more about, you know, covering your ass a little bit. You're less focused on the big win. And a little bit more of focus on yourself. And so I just think in general that, especially in the world of startups, and as long as you can keep that startup mentality, that idea that we're all in this to win something, and that everyone on the team, no matter what part they're playing in it, really understands what that vision is and is bought into it and wants to be a part of it, that team is going to outperform the greatest resumes on the planet.
What are some of your favorite memories from working with your team?
Oh, I have so many. I mean, there was a time when, all we did, and I'm not saying this is smart, by the way, but it was a time when we all worked together, played together, work was play, and I just spent my life in the office, which may sound like hell for some, but I worked with some of the smartest, best people, and we were all doing it together. And it was a wonderful family to be a part of. It was an interesting time too, because no one cared at that moment about work-life balance. Work was our life, and so therefore we were perfectly balanced. And it was really, really good times. And so I do. I have very different points of view now for myself on work-life balance now that I'm married. I have three kids, and it matters a lot more to me now than it did when I was building my first company. So I guess my advice would be, to everyone is to know what your happy place is, right? To know what makes you happy and don't judge yourself for it. And if that means that you have fewer hours to give, but you're going to work really smart and thoughtfully, or that you have all the time in the world to give and your happiness is working. And if as long as you don't burn yourself out, that's fine too.
I love that. It's also just being okay with knowing that your definition of happy changes.
Absolutely. Your definition of happy changes, and everyone's definition is different. And I think what's really important is that everyone sort of be in a similar place. It doesn't feel good to be the one person who leaves, or some people then judge the person who doesn't put it enough, but maybe they just do it differently. So I think it is one of those things that companies just have to be aware of, because you don't only want to attract the young people or the people who are, open to giving 24/7 to their job. And nor do I think, by the way, that makes you any better at your job when you give 24/7 to it. You're just like I talked about capital not being treated as carefully, I think that's true of time. And so, as a working mom now, I am really smart with how I spend my time. And when I didn't have to make those trade-offs, I wasn't as smart with my time.
I'm really glad that you kicked that off by mentioning the early days when you guys were all together and it didn't even really feel like work. Certainly you were doing a lot, but you loved it. So I was just chatting with an entrepreneur who's had four startups, and she was saying, when she was younger at her first company, she really saw herself as more as a friend and then realized, oh, I need to be a manager. I need to be a leader. I need to motivate people. Did you have an experience like that?
Absolutely. I remember us not understanding our roles as founders, right? I mean, we knew our roles were to get the funding in, bring in the best for the team, and hit these milestones, but forgetting that a key part of what you are is a leader. And what exactly does that mean? And that a lot of that means making sure that the people on your team are crystal clear about where things are headed, what's working, what's not, what success looks like for them. And if you don't understand that job, you're not going to do it, and you're not going to do it well, and that's going to make a big difference on how the team overall performs.
How did you learn how to do it?
It became aware that it was necessary. I don't remember an aha moment of saying, oh, wait, this is this thing that we forgot to do. But it definitely was an evolution of everyone just come on, join us. And we all go fast and furious off together to saying, okay, wait, it's a little chaotic. We need to just take a deep breath and be really clear and get everyone perfectly aligned with what we're trying to do, what the metrics are of the company, and then what everyone's sort of metrics are themselves that roll up into the company metrics. So I'm sure we had help from our VCs, and I'm sure we had help from the other people that we recruited to join us. But it wasn't like one day I remember getting this lesson. But there was an evolution to realizing that you're in this position, and there's a job in and of itself by being in that position.
When you look back on that time, regardless of when it was in your tenure as a founder, what's the biggest leadership lesson that stands out to you?
I think the biggest leadership lesson is just realizing how clear you have to be on where you're going, why you're going that way, and everyone's role in that. In my second company, we had some key core values, and one of them was purpose before action. And I think that sums it up so beautifully.
I'm nodding.
Yeah. I mean, to me, that's like the lights are on, you know, and I still, with one of my entrepreneurs just the other day, he was telling me about what he's doing. I said, why are you doing that? And he explained, and I said, but what's the purpose? Like, I get the action, but I don't see how that's going to help you get to your next, you know, the milestones that we've all, you know, jointly set, or really he had set. And he was like, oh my God, you're right. I got swept up. It was working and they really wanted it. And so sometimes you sort of go into this land of reactive and you start building on an idea and you get excited and the team can go off running, but you really want to be super aware of what am I trying to achieve? What are we trying to achieve? Then you can brainstorm away and think about the various ways that you can get there, but never lose sight of why you're doing whatever you are going to be doing.
How does it feel now for you when you're watching other entrepreneurs do all of these things?
You know, I have so many moments of gratitude for the incredible investors that I got to work with who cared enough and communicated well enough to turn the lights on for me. And so when I see it, I have gratitude for them. And then I try very much to emulate them and give them sort of that, give my entrepreneurs that same wisdom that was given to me. That was so game changing. And so I don't laugh at them. I don't, you know what I mean? Like, I don't forget that I ever was them. In fact, I feel more like an entrepreneur at heart than a VC at heart. But I would say that all in all, I just feel like, yep, okay, I learned this and now I shall embark that wisdom onto the next.
I love that. And I think it's such a great representation of the way you work and even just the numerous things that you constantly do to help and support me. It makes a world of a difference. So including this, I'm so grateful that we got to have you on the show today. For everyone listening in, Jenny, who wants to know more about your story and your experiences, how can they follow you on social media? And can you tell them about your work with Forbes so they can get all of those insights too?
And thank you, Jenna. So so you can follow me on Twitter, which is at Jenny Lefcourt. I am a Forbes contributor now, so you can find me on Forbes, but I usually will tweet when I post on Forbes. So following me on Twitter is probably the best of all. And that's it.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jenna.